Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the mental health section for this wonderful honor, and I'd like to say, too, it's a special privilege for me to be the joint recipient of the Tobe Award together with my great friend and colleague and mentor and reliable research collaborator of two decades, Marvin Smith. I certainly could never have accomplished such a thing without Marvin, and so thank you, Marvin. Congratulations. It's a great day for both of us. The topic of my presentation today is understanding psychiatric advanced directives. Now, I'm a researcher, so this is a research talk. I guess that's sort of the point, but it's also a story. It's kind of a story about how somebody can get interested in a topic and kind of catch the bit and follow it along through the stages of a research agenda and actually, hopefully, eventually produce some evidence that could change policy and practice and maybe even improve outcomes for some real people in terms of health and well-being. The story is also kind of a sequel to the story that Marvin has told. And if you think about it, it's kind of strange because it's hard to imagine two more different approaches to the problem of inadequately treated serious mental illness in the community than outpatient commitment and psychiatric advanced directives. I mean, one is about mandated community treatment and overriding people's right to refuse treatment, and it's thought of as sort of benign paternalism and maybe even not so benign, depending on who you ask. And psychiatric advanced directives is about personal autonomy and self-determined care and shared decision making and about recovery, and it's the alternative, it's the remedy, it's the antithesis of coercion. So it seems a little strange. On the other hand, it probably makes some sense that we should move from and find our way into studying psychiatric advanced directives through the pathway of outpatient commitment, because we get the coercion and the concern that actually has animated interest in psychiatric advanced directives. And so, you know, and then there's, you know, I mean, if Nixon went to China, maybe Dr. Swartz could be the one to study the psychiatric advanced directives. So, well, but what I will talk about today, I'm going to just say something about what PADS, and I'm going to use the acronym PADS so I don't have to say psychiatric advanced directives every single time, what they're about and how I got interested in studying them, and where PADS came from, a little bit about the legal context as well as what you might call sort of the social movement in the 1990s that led to PADS and all these statutes being passed. And then I'm going to summarize a little bit, skim over the top of our research evidence on PADS, kind of the stakeholder landscape, and then the prevalence and correlates of PADS in terms of the sort of the uptake. What are some of the barriers to completing and using PADS? Then I'm going to talk about our intervention that we developed as a structured facilitation to help people complete psychiatric advanced directives. And then some of the outcomes, short-term outcomes that may not actually have been part of the legislative intent, but could be benefits of PADS, and then long-term outcomes. And then I'll say something sort of anticlimactic, which is why it is that PADS remain promising but largely irrelevant so far. And that will sort of set up, I think, a point about implementation and dissemination and how you actually take a good idea and get it out there into usual care and the role of evidence in doing that. All right, so here's a definition, sort of ponderous. I'm going to read it so you can kind of focus on the technical features of psychiatric advanced directives. They're legal instruments that allow competent persons to document their decisions and preferences regarding future mental health treatment and or designate a surrogate decision maker in the event they lose capacity to make reliable treatment decisions during an acute episode of psychiatric illness. All right, now how does this work? So here's Jeff Swanson at time one. All right, now for sake of argument, let's just say, you know, he has reliable preferences and values and he's a competent, authentic decider. Right now, he may not do what you think he should do all the time, but he's competent. He has the right to decide. Well, now, what about this? What if Jeff Swanson at time one knows that out there in the future, there could come another, quote unquote, another Jeff Swanson who is quite different? And because of illness, this Jeff Swanson is an impaired decision maker. And when he's ill or incapacitated, he may not be able or willing to actually do the things that Jeff Swanson and Time One thought would be necessary and beneficial to actually recover and obtain treatment and so on. So what's happened is that decisional incapacity has formed a sort of a gap between the prior competent self and the future incompetent self. And there's a sort of a discontinuity of identity. I mean, that's a figure of speech. It's a metaphor. They really are the same two people, but I think it makes some sense to talk about that. All right, so advanced directives work like this. Now, the proxy decision maker at the top is a completely different person, just so you know. And so by means of a proxy decision maker and an advanced instruction, there is this bridge between the present competent self and the future incompetent self, and a way of controlling that period of incapacity and maintaining and actually achieving autonomy. How did I get interested in PADS? I think actually in hindsight, I've been interested in the ideas underlying PADS since I was an undergraduate college student, and I took this course in philosophical psychology, philosophy of the mind. And, you know, we explored sort of through language the meaning of personhood, features of personhood, and identity, and the continuity of the self over time, and the idea of agency of action. And then this raises the problem of incapacity. How do you think about that? And what do we mean when we say things like, she's not the same person anymore, or I wasn't myself when I did that? So these are very interesting ideas, and it leads to the ethical problem, how you think about the role of the person when the agency, the action, you know, may be incapacitated. Now, as a brief digression, I also at this time signed up for a course in medical sociology. I didn't know what this was. I was a 19-year-old college student, and we read Talcott Parsons. Now, if you've read Talcott Parsons, you find these amazing sentences in there, you know, and you can tell it's a sentence because it starts with a capital letter and it ends with a period. But inside are all of these clauses, you know, separated by prepositions and parentheses and so on. And you open up one of these clauses and you find these compound phrases. You open up the compound phrase and in there is a neologism. And you figure out what that means, and it's an interesting idea. Like, you're not just you. You're part of a functioning social system. And so when you become ill, that isn't just being ill. That is a role, a social role, with expectations incumbent on the person and, you know, the doctor and so on. And these were interesting ideas. And illness itself could be shaped and even determined by social factors and position in a social hierarchy, right? You tell a 19-year-old college student today that you read Talcott Parsons, they think you're out of your mind. They say, well, Dad, why didn't you just look it up in Wikipedia? You know? We didn't have Wikipedia, and we didn't even have computers. I mean, we did, but, you know, to use one, you had to go through the snow to a computer center, and you used a machine, and you punched these cards. And then after you had some of those, you put it through the shuffling machine. And then behind the shuffling machine was this giant box, and inside there were three or four dissident Soviet mathematicians with sideburns. And they were feverishly calculating, you know, all of the things on the instructions. Then that took 3 or 4 hours, and then you got this printout, which was the size and shape and weight of the Sunday New York Times, and you opened that up. There were all these error messages. So then, remember this? So you took that to this oracle. He was the error message guy, and he looked at it 3 seconds flat. He says, there it is, you knucklehead, you know, on card 17, you missed a semicolon. And you did. So, you know, but it was enough to make you go major in medieval music history. But you didn't do that. You stayed the course. You became a sociologist. And here you are today. So, flash forward. My first job in Texas, and I had a joint appointment in the Institute for the Medical Humanities, and I got mixed up with these lawyer ethicist guys, and they were interested in the idea of unwanted treatment at the end of life and how doctors make decisions. You know, I grew up as a doctor's son, believing that medical treatment was always a good thing. That's what you wanted. And sometimes you couldn't get it, but you wanted it. Well, guess what? People at the end of life, many times, receive medical interventions that keep them alive that don't make any sense. They're not beneficial. They don't want them. Even the doctors, if you ask them, say they wouldn't want these interventions. But they can't help it. The system can't help it. So thinking about how you avoid unwanted treatment was an interesting idea. And then I thought about that later, because I was in a psychiatry department. How does that relate to unwanted interventions in psychiatry and incapacity? So then when I came to North Carolina and started working with Marvin on this issue of outpatient commitment, we came to this controversy about a coercion. And that really led to an interest in advanced directives. And in 1997, our state passed this, along with other states that had done this. Then in 2000, there was this really interesting court case, this word from the federal court, that I got very interested in. And it was the case of Hargrave versus Vermont. Just very briefly, Nancy Hargrave was a woman with schizophrenia who had been hospitalized many times. She had taken antipsychotic medications, and she knew she did not want them. So she authorized, when she was competent, through a durable power of attorney, a refusal of all antipsychotic medications. She got hospitalized. Her healthcare agent said, you can't give Nancy Hargrave any medicine. And, well, it so happened there was a law in the books in New York, in Vermont at that time, that said that after 45 days, the hospital could override that and treat the patient anyway. And they did that. And Nancy Hargrave was treated involuntarily. She got better. She got out of the hospital. And she retained a civil rights legal team and sued everybody and the state of Vermont under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And they made the argument that if she had been a medical patient with terminal illness, she could have used the same legal instrument to refuse medical interventions and would have been allowed to die. But because she was a psychiatric patient, they used a different rule, a different law. And she won this case in the district court. It was then appealed to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. At that point, doctors started getting nervous because they thought, well, what if this passes? Then all these people with poor insight into illness are going to use these directives, and they're going to refuse all treatment. And we'll be in this situation of detain but do not treat. And then something interesting happened. There was an amicus curiae brief that was filed with all of these former mental health commissioners, and maybe even Dr. Shern, I don't remember, that actually supported Nancy Hargrave. And that was interesting because they made the argument that if you really want this instrument to work, then it has to be powerful and authoritative enough to work in a situation where the patient is disagreeing with the psychiatrist, not just agreeing with it. And so it was kind of a clever way of trying to empower this, these instruments. Now we know that almost nobody uses a pad to do what Nancy Hargrave did. But no, that wasn't known at that time. So there are two legal types of instruments embedded in pads, the instructional directive and the procedural authorization of a proxy decision maker. I think of pads as a device for communication. Unfortunately, they're often a one-way communication. They need to be two-way communication devices. But what do they communicate? They communicate treatment decisions, advanced consent, and refusal. Now, you can get into an argument with a bioethicist about whether all of the elements of informed consent actually do reside in an advanced directive, but they are used in this way. They also convey or forecast preferences and values to guide future decisions. They can have emergency information in them, just stuff that would be useful to know when someone's sick and unable to decide or communicate for themselves. And some people think of them as a portable psychiatric resume, sort of a précis of your history of illness and treatment and what has worked for you in the past, just information that would be good to know if treaters don't know this patient. Then they provide a limited waiver of confidentiality, allowing, for example, families to discuss with inpatient or treatment team members the patient's condition. And some people think of pads as a Ulysses contract. And in the law, in some statutes in particular, are embedded these kinds of self-commitment features where you can actually authorize treatment over your own objection in the future. Where did pads come from? You could point to some benchmarks in the development of medical advance directives. Insofar as they really emerged from medical advance directives, the Supreme Court decision in the Cruzan case really established the standard of evidence for, you know, what should count as knowing what an incapacitated patient would have wanted. Clear and convincing evidence. And this really defined the need for written documentation, because if you want your wishes to be known in a clear and convincing way, then write them down. And at about the same time, this led to the Patient Self-Determination Act, which required all hospitals receiving federal funds to ask to inquire patients upon admission if they had advance directives, to have a policy for implementing them, to tell people what that was. Now, where do they really come from? I think this is kind of where PADS came from, the psychiatric variation. And that is, and this is some typical survey findings from one of our studies in North Carolina. These are psychiatric outpatients with serious mental illness in the public system, and asked them, well, have you ever had these things happen to you? And 82% reported at least one of these kinds of things, being transported to treatment in a police cruiser, handcuffs, involuntary commitment, seclusion and restraint, forced medications. And these are upsetting things for people. And it's not that they don't want treatment, but they don't want it with the trappings of criminalization. They want it on their own terms. And that is something that really drove interest in PADS. So I would say the driving factor in moving and in appropriating these instruments for use for temporary incapacity, in this case of PADS, really came from this widespread concern with coercion and social control in mental health treatment. And PADS were seen as the alternative to that. There was at the same time this new emphasis on recovery and hope and patient-centeredness in care and shared decision-making in mental health. It really was kind of a reaction to all of the decades when people were locked up in institutions and didn't have any control. And new treatment technologies as well that made this possible. Mental health advocates, well, then there's families played a big role. Families were interested in PADS because of the vehicle of the proxy decision maker, and often that is the person who's appointed. And then advocates really came together with other constituents like NAMI, Mental Health Consumer Advocacy Organizations, academic bioethicists, legal experts, and to support PAD legislation. It was spearheaded in a number of states by the protection and advocacy attorneys. And so here you have a graph that shows the growth in these special laws, starting in the first half of the 1990s, five states, and then more. And finally, the latest is Montana, so there are 26 states in all that have passed these special advance instruction for mental health treatment laws, or mental health advance declaration, or different variations on this. The states that don't have these actually can do the same thing with their existing healthcare decisions laws by simply authorizing a proxy decision maker and giving that person instructions. But often these statutes built in forms, special forms, to deal with the issues that are unique to people with mental illness. So, in the middle 2000s, after a lot of these laws had been passed, Marvin and I were part of the MacArthur Network and did the survey in five cities, and these were, again, people with serious mental illness, public sector treatment settings, outpatients, and we asked people how whether they had actually done one of these, and only 4% to 13% across these sites had done that. So, not much uptake after all of this interest and attention. Then we asked a different question. We said, would you want to complete a PAD if someone showed you how? Now that you know what it is, and if someone were actually help you do it, would you want to? And this is the answer. 66% to 78% across these settings said they wanted this. So we saw that as an indication of really a lot of latent demand. We also surveyed stakeholders in North Carolina about the law that was passed here, consumers and family members and clinicians. Pretty much uniformly, over 80% said that they thought these two laws were a good thing. They actually were two laws that worked together to make a PAD. So there's a lot of support and a lot of latent demand, but little uptake. So this leads to a research question. What are the barriers? So what's preventing this good idea from being implemented? And we did research on that, too. We surveyed barriers to completion and use of PADS in different stakeholder groups. And then we developed this intervention I'm going to tell you a little bit about. Does structured PAD facilitation actually work for people with serious mental illness? Does it overcome these barriers? And then when consumers do complete PADS, what do the what documents contain? What do they put in them? Do they use them like Nancy Hargrave did? Or do they put in things that it makes sense, that clinicians would think useful and feasible? And then, do they work? Do they actually have some short-term benefits indirect benefits like making people more feel more empowered? Do they maybe improve working alliance with outpatient clinicians because there's a chance to talk to them and plan ahead? Do they improve people's treatment satisfaction? And then do they actually reduce crises and the use of coercion during incapacitating crisis? And we've studied these things in several studies over time. So here's some of the barriers at the level of consumers in this study that we did. Things like, I don't understand what PADS, enough about them. I think it would be hard to find someone to help me do it. I don't know what to say or write in a PAD. I don't really have anyone I trust enough to make decisions for me. I don't have a doctor I trust. I don't like to sign legal documents. 85% endorsed one of these barriers, and 55% reported three or more. So this is you know, we have our work cut out for us in designing an intervention. And this is what we developed. A 60 to 90 minute session, and this was based on a fairly well-established facilitation intervention for medical advanced directives by the Gunderson Lutheran organization. And it was a sort of a guided, structured discussion of future treatment choices, and people's choices were validated. But it discusses with people kind of as a reality test. You know, if someone says, well, if I become ill, I want to go to the Betty Ford Center, or I want to take ginkgo and nothing else. Well, you know, you can put whatever you want to in there. It's your God-given right. But people, you know, the facilitator will discuss those things. And then the practical issues, witnesses and notarization, making sure it's filed in the medical record, having copies to the proxy decision maker, and so on. So we then got this study funded jointly as an R01 from NIMH, and the MacArthur Network supplied supplementary funding. We enrolled a sample of 469 consumers with serious mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression with psychotic features, people who would be at risk of having decisional incapacity. And we did another experiment. We randomly assigned them to two groups. One was the experimental group where they got this facilitation, and the other was they got information about it, they got a brochure, they got a referral to existing resources in the system. This is a good idea, this is what it is, go do it. And then we followed people up over 2 years, and we did structured interviews, and we got all their records, put all this together, and looked at multiple outcomes, clinical outcomes, system events like getting hospitalized and arrested, and attitudinal changes, and so on. So key findings. The experiment in terms of whether this would produce completed PADS was wildly successful. 61% of people in the intervention group completed an advanced directive, 3% in the group where we gave them the brochure and the referral to the system. Then of the people who actually sat down with the facilitator, I mean, a lot of people, not a lot, but some refused even that. But if they sat down and actually had the facilitator meet with them, this is what we found. 68% completed both the advanced instruction and the proxy decision maker authorization, healthcare power of attorney. 23%, which is sort of telling, did the standalone instruction, didn't have any proxy decision maker. This is just my document. Do what this says. 5% authorized a proxy, gave them carte blanche with no instructions. And 8% didn't do it even after meeting with the facilitator. Then we did a content analysis, what was in these documents. We found, first of all, that almost all of them had a mix of prescriptive and proscriptive instructions, things that people wanted to get and things they did not want to get. So it was instructions about medicine. It was, I do want to take Zyprexa, but don't give me Haldol. You know, don't give me ECT. But I do want this. And the same with hospitals. I do want to go to my local hospital. I don't want to be carted off to the regional psychiatric, public psychiatric hospital, you know, three counties away. They included information about relapse, what kinds of things trigger their relapse, crisis symptoms, as I was mentioning, medication and hospitalization. Almost everybody refused ECT, even if they would not be a candidate for it necessarily. And then we had two psychiatrists independently rate these with a rating system, looking at their feasibility, their consistency with clinical practice. And they were, almost all of them rated very, very highly on that, the facilitated PADS. A summary of what we found in the outcomes in the study, we found that at 1 month, already, there was a significant improvement in reported working alliance with case managers. And this is partly because just simply doing this generated at least one additional visit to talk about it, and the talking about it and the feeling empowered of putting your own choices in the advance directive actually had some benefit measurable in terms of working alliance. Increased treatment satisfaction at 6 months, endorsing these items on the MISIP scale. As a result of services I received, I deal more effectively with daily problems. I'm better able to control my life. I get along better with my family. I do better in school and work. Higher utilization among the PAD completers of outpatient services for medication management and crisis prevention. Increased concordance at one year between the requested medicines in the PAD and what actually was prescribed. So these things tended to converge over time. Now what's interesting is all of those four outcomes, none of those really are in the legislative intent of what a PAD is supposed to do. You could have all those benefits even if you never had the incapacitating crisis that a PAD is designed to control. And people had fewer crisis episodes, again, fewer of the actual events that the law is designed to control. And finally, reduced likelihood of coercive crisis interventions. All those things that you saw on the list, like getting arrested and transported by the police, seclusion and restraints, involuntary medication, and so on. Now, there are problems remaining, even though these are promising results, and that is with the implementation. So we have surveyed clinicians, and they report to us, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, a number of barriers that we can kind of separate them into what we call operational barriers, clinical barriers, and just legal defensiveness. And we have a scale that measures that. So there are things like, doctors will say, psychiatrists will say, psychologists will say, but there just is a lack of coordination and communication between the two sectors that have to work together here in a crisis, the outpatient and the inpatient teams don't talk to each other. And there's lack of access to this document. If you don't have a centralized registry, there's no way to know that it exists. So what good is it going to do? It's like a message in a bottle. You put your pad in the bottle, throw it in the ocean, hope somebody will find it. Then there's what we would call clinical barriers. Clinicians are concerned that there are going to be inappropriate treatment requests, and they're going to be obliged to follow them. That consumers will want to change their minds in a crisis, that they will, that the time two person is going to say, whoop, rip this thing up, I don't want this pad anymore. And that they don't know if the person was really competent to begin with, because competency is presumed. There's no way to tell, whether the person was truly competent. That's a presumption. And finally, just legal defensiveness. And I mean the telling comment here. Would I rather be sued by a patient because I didn't follow their advance directive or by someone else because I did? So doctors, whether it's rational or not, it's real, and they act sometimes on their legal defensiveness. Here are some differences in stakeholders' perceptions of PADs that I think are also telling in terms of just the optimism about whether they're going to work. There's a lot more optimism among consumers thinking this is going to be a good thing, less in families and clinicians. The issue of revocation. So, 40% of the consumers think they should be able to change their mind even in a crisis and deauthorize the proxy decision maker or tear up the advance directive. And families, 10%, a little bit more, say that because they think the whole point is that you don't change your mind in a crisis. And clinicians, a little bit higher than that. 60% of the consumers say doctors should pay a legal penalty if they don't follow it. And that's actually built into these laws. But, clinicians, 10% of them think that should happen. So, another finding from the sort of barriers clinician survey, we provided a vignette to psychiatrists. And we said, okay, you're a psychiatrist in an emergency setting, and family members bring a really ill person in who has a competent advance directive, and it refuses hospitalization and medication. Now, the patient is psychotic. They're not violent. So there's a little bit of question about whether they're committable. And they're brought by the family members. And so what do you do? Well, we found almost an even split. Half the doctors saying they would override this directive, and the other half, which they actually can do in the statutes there, these override features, and the other half saying they would go ahead and follow it. And there were correlates of which was more likely in these response scenarios. So doctors who actually worked in the emergency setting were more likely to say they would override. If they were concerned about patient violence and lack of insight, they were more likely to override. And if they were legally defensive on our scale of legal defensiveness. So we've written a paper about that as well. So let me just summarize my findings, and then I'll stop. So just moving through this whole topic, we identified, you know, this is a good idea. We found a large latent demand, but very low completion of advanced directives among public mental health consumers. We found that this intervention we developed could actually overcome these barriers, and most people did complete them. And when they did, the documents were rated as consistent and useful by clinicians, consistent with clinical practice standards. Even though PADS are designed, I think this is important, legally for to determine the treatment during an incapacitating crisis, they can have these indirect benefits that people didn't think about so much, about improving sort of empowerment and engagement in outpatient treatment that can prevent crises, prevent the incidents that they're designed to control legally. And PADS can help prevent crises as well as reduce the use of coercion when crises occur. What's needed now is system-wide implementation efforts, because PADS remain a promising idea with little implementation and usual care. That's what we're doing now. We're trying to get a study funded where we would use peer specialists, ideal people, to work on facilitating PADS as part of ACT teams, and just get this into usual care, so that if we get more PADS out there, then we can really try to see a system impact. And actually, it needs to be a top-down implementation in the system as well, in trying to change clinicians' attitudes about receiving these. And here is our National Resource Center on Psychiatric Advanced Directives. It has three portals into it. You can go in as a consumer, as a legal professional, or as a clinician, and you can find information tailored to you. You can go to any state and click on that state and download that state's forms about psychiatric advanced directives. There's 10 FAQs that tell you all about it. You can read research on it with a constantly updated research report. And this is part of the implementation effort as well. So thank you very much.
Yeah, the juxtaposition of looking at the assisted outpatient treatment and the PADS is really provoking and interesting. So thank you so much. We do have about 7 minutes for some questions.
Yeah.
Have a little more discussion about this. David.
Great presentation, guys. Thank you so much. And just a really nice portfolio of work in this area. Marv, I was thinking about, you know, you said that I may get this wrong, you correct me if I do, in the New York study, you had an opportunity to ask people about how coercive they felt the treatment was, the patients themselves. They didn't report it as being particularly coercive. And so I'm wondering, what do you think the active ingredient is? So we know the availability of services is important. People are not seeing this necessarily as a coercive intervention. What's your sense about the active ingredient? And do you think there's anything about the sort of the dose effect that actually has to do with negotiating a kind of a compromise position and sort of a workable plan for people who find themselves in this AOT?
That's a good question. So just to clarify what I said, what I meant to say, and what the findings have been both in North Carolina and in New York, is that relative to previous treatment experiences in which people typically have revolved in and out of hospitals and been involuntarily committed and all this stuff, relative to that, they don't find outpatient commitment much worse. And that's an important point, perspective, I think, in looking at this population, because it's a real relative to what question. Because, you know, as you know, too, we, you know, did this preferences assessment study and found that, by and large, folks, you know, would rather have services, have a place to live, you know, not be homeless. You know, so if there's benefits to outpatient commitment, they'll take it.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, civil liberties are not like number one on their list. And that doesn't make it right or wrong. It's just from the perspective of the consumer, I think they've had so many adverse experiences, this doesn't really rate as the thing that bothers them the most. One of the interesting observations, I think, about in New York when we're working there is that one of the things that outpatient commitment does is that it you have these this a different an additional level of oversight of the system, and someone who's saying, okay, what are the services of this person supposed to have, and how do they get to it? And is this provider, you know, in New York, which is sort of this, you know, far more elaborate system of private providers, there's no real Uber case manager. And the interesting thing about what AOT does in New York is it puts this sort of agent of accountability over the order. And that person is saying, well, did the person get here? Did they get there? Are they following? Are the providers following the treatment plan? Is the consumer? And I think what the element of AOT that I don't think we've quantified as well as we might is that there are no accountability elements in mental health services. We have this arborization of services, and we have empowerment and choice and recovery, but we don't have sort of someone who is saying, okay, did all this happen? And I think that that's sort of a latent function of AOT that we haven't fully explored. And if someone were going to fund research like this, would they not? And they're not. The study that you would do, I think, is saying if you had some other form of accountability that's voluntary, how would it stack up versus the legal apparatus that you're using through the moral authority of the judge? And I think you would find that if there were someone who's over the system, sort of making things happen, that might be just as effective. And there may be an opportunity to do that as a naturalist experiment. So I think to the consumers, it's not the coercion per se. I think to everyone, there is some resentment of that accountability agent. Because in AOT, the people hated the AOT oversight group.
The patients did?
Everybody hated it. Well, it was also a paper system, and it was clunky and this and that. But I, in some ways, that was like this other piece.
Just to add one thing to that, and on the question of the active ingredient, because I think one needs to separate out the coercion and the perceived downside of that from the moral authority of the judge of the court. Because, you know, we've studied this, people don't actually know that they're not required to take their medicine, but they act as if they are. So if you look at this as a mediator, there's a significantly improved level of adherence to prescribed medication. If you assume that works, that's probably an important thing that happens. So there's probably a mix between the leverage on the individual's own adherence behavior and the leverage on the system that Margaret's talking about.
Yes, I have a question about related to the North Carolina study and the number of hospitalizations. What I'm wondering is when a clinician sees a patient for a very brief period of time, if the hospitalizations, the increased number of hospitalizations before your AOT or in that trip, you know, for so many days, could be more of a representative of a proxy for the clinician's anxiety rather than the patient's status, you know, itself. As you know, over the years, you see a young, say, inexperienced resident who might be much more willing to commit or go, you know, suggest hospitalization for a patient than someone who's established a relationship and may say, oh, well, that's just them. Give them a few hours or a couple, you know, call me in the morning and let's, you know, work it out. Or, you know, they just get to know the patient. So that what I wonder is, again, is the anxiety, are we measuring the anxiety level of the clinician rather than the patient's? Kind of provocative, but I'd like to see that in some kind of research.
Well, I mean, you can turn it around. I mean, consistent with that, you could also say, well, maybe what outpatient commitment is doing is giving the clinician confidence that the aftercare arrangements are more secure. And if you frame it that way, I think that's probably pretty plausible. I'm not sure about the and we haven't measured that, so I don't, you know, your scenario, you know, is possible. But I think something intuitively that makes more sense that's consistent with that is this idea as well, if you know that there's something out there that's going to be a safety net for the patient that's decompensating, then you might take more risks in not hospitalizing the patient.
It is noon. So the good thing is that both Dr. Schwartz and Dr. Swanson will be at our reception tonight, which is 7 p.m. here in the Hotel Farragut Square Room. So please come. You're going to have more conversation with them. And just one last round of applause.